This is Jerry Bain at the ELI 2009 Annual Conference in Orlando, Florida. I'm here with Barbara Droud, Assistant Vice President for Academic and Instructional Technologies at Middle Tennessee State University, Sandy Schaefer, Director of the Advanced Learning Center at the University of Memphis, Gail Matthew DiNatale, Associate Director of Academic Technology at Simmons College, and Michael Fry, Professor of Mathematical Science at Lebanon Valley College. Thanks for joining me today. Appreciate it. We're talking about introducing new technology to faculty, and I'd like to start with a quote from an introduction to the paper on EduChallenge learning scenarios and get a reaction from all of you from this quote I found. A large number of innovation efforts are taking place at universities at the moment. However, many of these endeavors typically result in few changes and high frustration of the people involved. The change promoters feel dissatisfied by the perceived resistance of their colleagues, and the skeptics feel confirmed in their opinion that a lot of time and money is wasted for nothing. So as we try to move toward IT fluency and innovation in the university curriculum, why are we often running into these dead ends, do you guys think?
I think that there's a lot of different factors that play into whether faculty adopt new technologies and adopt new innovative teaching methods, whether that involves technology or not. And I think it's partially kind of the history of their discipline, the history of the university, the reward structures on campus, things like promotion and tenure and things like that. So I don't think it's a problem that can necessarily be either addressed by or blamed on the technology. It's more of a problem with all the different pieces fitting together, and it may be that technology pieces may be moving faster than some of the other pieces that also need to be addressed.
I had a certain reaction to this when the question or the quote talked about institutions providing these opportunities for innovation, and I had this sort of immediate visceral reaction that institutions in administrations, and I work for an administration, we don't tend to innovate. Individuals innovate. So this notion of top-down innovation efforts, we've tried them a few times on my campus, and the more top-down they are, the more likely they are to not succeed. The innovations that I've seen succeed are usually done at the individual level, that individuals innovate. So that was my first thought, and I don't know what some of my other colleagues have about that, thought about that.
Well, I feel that, and part of this is the influence of the keynote speech this morning by Mike Wesch, is why is it then when we're talking about students, we're saying crisis of significance? You know, are we asking significant questions? Are we doing things that are worth doing? But then we turn around, and when we're talking about working with faculty, we're talking about the people being disappointed or perceived resistance. Now, if we were in the same situation in a classroom and saying, why are these students resistant to learning or whatever, you know, with the frame that we have, we would be saying, are we offering something that's significant? So to me, I think one of the biggest problems is that we tend to, because we're so immersed in the technology, we tend to lead with the technology. So no matter what the question is, technology needs to be in the answer. And I would think that we would make more progress if we led with some of those more significant questions, like what is learning? How do my students learn? You know, in what ways is the way that my students learning different from the way that I learn or the way that I teach? And then let technology and emerging technologies have their natural place within that conversation. I think people would be more on a broader range of people would be, yeah, those are questions worth pursuing.
It's like Susan Mitra said in a discussion yesterday, we need to look at the goals before we look at the tools.
I agree, but I also think that at a more institutional level, sometimes the importance and the value of talking about how are we teaching and how are students learning isn't necessarily the things that are being broadly disseminated across the campus, that a lot of discussion is more kind of discipline-specific, content-specific, how do I improve the output of the department, not getting back to some of the basics about the learning that's taking place. And I think sometimes, while I agree with what Sandy said in terms of, you know, innovation starts with the faculty member, there's got to be a balance, because you can be innovative but it not go anywhere if you don't feel like, you know, you're doing anything but batting your head against the wall.
You know, and maybe the thing the institution could do, I was listening to you and thinking about the other comments I've heard, is maybe what the institution could do is set a tone for emphasis on learning in general. You know, we self-flagellate on that question all the time in higher ed, but the institutional environment of we place a value on teaching and learning with and student outcomes perhaps would be a more fruitful exercise. And then the fact that technology could perhaps help in some ways should be a secondary discussion.
I think it's also about creating space. I mean, how do we create spaces for some of those conversations? Because some of the concern about my discipline is built on certain assumptions that my discipline is very, very different and very, very unique. And we find, at least at Simmons, when we get a range of people in a room sharing what they do with group work or with classroom assessment and online or whatever, that they find some of the pieces that they have in common. So I think that those kind of peer conversations and creating enough space for those conversations to go deep enough.
And space not only in terms of physical space where to sit, but space in terms of in your schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I talk to faculty about, you know, can we help you learn this or what that, the most common thing they say is, I don't have the time to do that. And so I mean, I think we need to think very broadly in saying, how do we find the space, time, you know, location, all that kind of stuff, so that we can share? Because I believe that that's the way it's going to get from the individual faculty to be much broader if they share. But that, I think, is another thing that, you know, historically academia is not based on. It's not really based on sharing. It's based on, you know, I am the expert in this particular discipline, and let me share that expertise with you. And our classes have historically been very much silos and things like that. One of the things that I think will help the dissemination of any kind of information, whether it's technology or just good plain old teaching, is being able to share more often.
Well, a little bit of what we're doing is just talked about the failure of institutional projects. And instead, I think we are wisely turning to encouraging sharing with each other. That's what our school has done, is increase the amount of sharing of faculty with each other. It's not something that comes natural, but it's something we've started to recognize we have to do. If all we know is a goal and don't see a path to get there, then it's not going to happen.
Exactly.
But by sharing with each other and finding out what each other does now, we might be able to see one step we can take toward what we want to do.
And I think the sharing goes beyond faculty to faculty, but it also goes from administrative level to administrative level. I think one thing that I often see at this conference, I'm very much an academician, but I report to the IT side. And, you know, that sometimes makes you feel like you're kind of in the middle. But with, you know, our organizational structure the way it is, and being that, you know, I report to the CIO, it just strengthens so much the idea that those two pieces and then all the other pieces, but they have to work together. You can't have advancement of new technologies if the IT department doesn't work well with the academic departments, and vice versa. You're not going to have good teaching, because teaching nowadays has got to involve technology without good communication back and forth.
And I think that there's this question of top-down, bottom-up, or whatever. And I believe that there are some things that on the face of it wouldn't relate to this question, but do in terms of on the top level. So, for example, in our strategic planning that we're working on now at Simmons College, every group is being asked to read an article on collaboration. So that's from the president's office is saying collaboration is important. Well, I think that if you sort of take that stand, then some of these other pieces can fall in place if people are walking the talk on that level.
And I think that is so important right now in this economic situation that we're in right now, because, again, we're in the middle of strategic talks in terms of how to cut budgets. And people, again, are kind of narrowing and saying, I got to protect my own. But I don't think that's the way that we're going to, first of all, survive the economic activities, but also be able to move forward, is we've got to say, okay, it's not a matter of me just doing more with less. It's a matter of us doing more together.
It's nice that a lot of the improvements won't take a lot of money anymore. Once they did, a lot of the cataclysmic failures were hugely expensive projects. with lots of equipment, lots of expensive equipment. And that's not what we're seeing as what's needed now. That's not what we're talking about doing here. We're using free products mostly and looking at just changes in what we do rather than having to get a lot of expensive new technology.
But I do want to go back to an expense that it's a concern to me, something that does threaten, because I agree with you that a lot of the sort of technologies that we're talking about really don't have to take that much money. However, if in a time of economic crisis, fewer core courses are being taught by adjuncts and the full-time faculty are having their teaching load increase, then that time that you're talking about, that resource, that space to say for, at Simmons we have week-long faculty institutes that are take place in a blended mode. So they're doing part of their work online, they're doing part of their work face-to-face. Incredibly generative, but that's the pressures on either side. If they're teaching a higher course load, it's going to be a challenge.
Exactly.
I wanted to ask, where the rubber meets the road, how much of the population of professors are, this is how I teach math, this is what I do, and I go home? Unlike people like gathered around this table that are actually interested in change.
I think it's so much more complex, and we're used to sort of putting people into one category or another. And I've got sort of two short examples as a case in point. One faculty member that when I came to Simmons, people said, oh, she's a Luddite. She doesn't like to do anything with technology, so don't worry about her. Now, it turned out, while she was ambivalent about technology, she was incredibly visionary with her pedagogy. And in creating a game, working with Barnard College, in conversation with her about what was so amazing about her game, she found her way into that a wiki was going to be able to help her accomplish her goals, that e-portfolios were going to be able to accomplish her goals. So she could have been labeled as a resistant person. And in fact, she's one of these people that I'm just in awe every time I talk with her. Second example, head of the curriculum committee, who was asking questions that on the surface of it might have seemed to indicate a lot of resistance to a blended learning initiative that we have. What she was doing actually was she was trying to figure out the why of blended learning. And as she sort of puzzled through some of the pieces in the context of this institute, she wound up then calling for a meeting with all of the adjuncts, with all of the full-time faculty. And she got up and she said, you know, I'm X number of years away from retirement, so this is not really for my era, but I am convinced that this is the next era. And we need to be having these conversations now, so that we can be thinking about this strategically and in the most meaningful possible way. Now, those are two people that could be written off as resistant. But actually, if we have the sort of the human dignity piece in our conversations with them, I think we have partners.
Going back to your question, I honestly don't believe there's a lot of faculty out there that fall into where you say, teach my class and that's all I'm doing. I think the complexity is that faculty are pulled in so many different directions and they have to make a choice because there's only a certain number of hours in a day. And what I think we as technology support people have to be careful that we don't label someone, you know, if, you know, they have made a really informed decision that their priorities right now have to go this way. We can't necessarily look down on them because of that. What I think as a whole university, we have to do is help them figure out, well, how can that priority be shifted, or how can, you know, there be balance over time? So maybe, yes, this year, this has to be a priority. And then maybe next year, something else can be a priority. It's, I think, a matter of balance.
One of the things that faculty are afraid of risking is content transmission. I've heard it said that faculty are risk averse. But that isn't necessarily true, but it's high stakes for them to lose to have a class go out and be not ready for the next class in the sequence.
Right.
And so they're not ready to risk making it involving students in more of the control of the content of the course and thus them not getting something that's essential for later on. I think that tends to make faculty more conservative about changing the way they teach.
So, Mike, are you suggesting that there's a feeling of less control? I'm guessing
they don't want to give
here,
up control.
You teach with technology. I'm presuming that you have some behavior pattern in that direction, right?
But there, I feel constraints in doing that because I teach a pre-calculus class and I need my students to be ready for calculus when they're done. And so that really limits what I'm going to do in how I'm going to use the ideas I hear here about letting students form their own learning space and, you know, controlling what's going to happen.
So, Mike, when you stop and think about investing some time in fiddling around with technology to use it in whatever way you might for your students, how do you balance that in with all the other things I'm assuming that you're expected to do as a faculty member at Lebanon? I'm sure you have a scholarly responsibility, you have some social and service responsibilities. I'm sure you're on a couple of committees. You're here today. How do you make judgments about a new technology comes along that you might find interesting, a wiki or a little camera or something like that that might relate? How do you make judgment calls about when to stop and spend some time on that?
I make little changes at a time in a direction that I can see how to get there. But I'm slow. And I'm skeptical. Is this really going to do me any good? One of the questions I'll have is there evidence that it's necessary for me to go in this direction? Where we're going to be talking about information fluency programs or efforts in information fluency, and I think faculty want evidence that it's necessary to make that effort.
I think that's an important thing. I think, again, sometimes as technology people, and, you know, we all were probably the early adopters of, you know, lots of different things because of that. But, you know, we have to really make sure that we don't, like you said earlier, lead with the technology. You know, you want to lead with the learning and the outcomes that you're trying to accomplish, but also realizing that you can't change everything at one time because then you don't know what worked and what didn't work. So small steps, I think, are an important way for us to move toward adopting technologies. Because, again, why jump in at the deep end if you can start at the shallow end and work your way up?
And there's so many different levels of expertise or familiarity. I was talking to an instructional technologist recently who said he has faculty coming to him that say to him, I want to use technology in my class. And he'll say, well, what do you want to do? I don't know. I just want to use technology. So you got a very wide spectrum of people.
And you have a wide spectrum of skills. So, I mean, I think that as a way of kind of introducing these new technologies or introducing any technology is, again, sitting down and starting with what are you trying to accomplish? And as you were saying, in what direction do you want to go? Then we decide where it is. I think sometimes we surprise faculty that come to us with that, and instead of saying, okay, let's sit down at the computer and let me show you this and let me show you that and let me show you this, sit down at a table and say, you know, what are you trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. And it does help them kind of turn their thoughts around to say, oh, well, this is maybe what I want to go with or something like that.
There's a question that I really don't know the answer to and I grapple with all the time. Barbara, earlier you were saying that any of this involves a certain amount of collaboration. It's gotten complex and big enough that for really good and satisfactory experiences, we're called upon to collaborate with one another in a different kind of way. And then Mike, you were saying the healthy skepticism is, you know, where's the evidence that this is needed? And I think that sometimes I feel like there's a pressure from my position to be the person who sort of scurries about and gets the evidence. But I wonder if that's kind of in the wrong place, because it's really not about me getting evidence to give to a faculty member to prove the point, because then I'm sort of in some kind of booster marketing, mm-hmm. whatever kind of relationship that I don't want to be in. So aware of the fact that discretionary time is nil, non-existent for faculty, how do we have this be some kind of a collaborative process in which we say, well, what is the evidence? I don't know. I do have some pieces of the puzzle, but what do you think the evidence would be that this would be needed, or what would constitute evidence for you?
Well, I have some thoughts on this. Think about how much change we're trying to introduce in a relatively short amount of time in the history of education. You know, and as Mike, you were saying, what was the term you used? Not skeptical. Maybe you said you're a skeptic, yeah, mm-hmm. and that you're perhaps conservative or reserved or however you approach it. But, you know, when did we start with teaching with technology in any significant way? Less than 10 years. How long have we created an environment that we trust to produce good learning outcomes? Hundreds of years. So I see you shaking your head. Barbara will have something to comment. I'm just thinking about how much we're asking a culture to absorb in such a short amount of time. That's not traditionally a walk in and tell you what to do. This is not IBM. It's not the FBI. Mm-hmm. This is higher education, where faculty are encouraged and free to make independent decisions based on their experiences and perspectives. And we're asking for dramatic, I consider it significant change and adoption of things, new things, in a relatively short amount of time to get comfortable with that.
Well, I kind of agree with that, but I think it also depends how you define technology. I mean, back in the day, a piece of chalk could have been defined as technology.
Certainly.
So, I mean, we've had it. I think that, though, you are correct in saying that there is so much more information. You know, information now doubles in a matter of minutes, and it seems, as opposed to when it, in the past it might have doubled in 20 years, 30 years, or whatever. So, I mean, I do agree with that.
Maybe I should say the level of change, and technology is functioning as a change agent. Maybe mm-hmm. I should clarify, because I agree with your point about there has been technology in the classroom. A book is a technology. When we went from standing up and lecturing to having the printing press was a huge change. So
I totally agree with you that the amount of new things, whether it's, you know, a new textbook, a new technology, a new form that you have to fill out, you know, there are so many new things that faculty have to deal with. It is hard to keep up with all of that. But I still think it goes back to kind of helping faculty decide what is best for them and their particular discipline.
Well, we're on the topic of skepticism. I'd like to question whether or not technology is inherently a change agent. Hmm. I mean, a lot of what we say, we sort of presume that we've got all these things and it's just going to transform teaching and learning as we know it. But if you go back to, say, for example, the advent of television or some of the kind of satellite productions,
broadcast,
mm-hmm. that rhetoric was all over. It was really going to change the way. And, you know, did it? To a large extent, it didn't. And I think that's, again, a sort of a leading with the technology piece. I think that we will change if we have the time and the resources and the support to really dig into some of these deep questions, to gather some of the evidence, and to gather it in such a way that it's collaborative. So it's not a skepticism. It's not like I'm giving you a survey results and you're going, well, you created the survey and you obviously are in academic technology, so you obviously want me to use this, so this is not real research. So those kinds of the partnerships, the evidence gathering, and the getting down to what do we really want? What do we really care about?
Well, the change that's actually been underway for us is active learning, not technology. That's in my subject, it's definitely a big change to go to active learning. That's a hard transition by itself, but technology I'm only seeing as a tool that one can use to change the way active learning can work, to improve the degree to which students control what's going on.
So I think it goes back to, as you're saying, it's the instructional design, not the tool that you use to reach your outcome, but whether or not you set your outcomes correctly and whether or not you set your activities to reach those outcomes deeply or not correctly. It's not the right word, but deeply. So whether or not you know, if you want to use active learning, if jumping up and running around the room is the best mechanism to reach the outcome that you want to use, then that's the most appropriate learning activity to have. If interacting on a wiki and being able to collaborate on that is the best tool to use, then you do that. So that it still always has to go back to how you design what you're trying to accomplish in the first place.
Yeah, I don't need technology, for example, to get my students to work with each other and help each other. But I need technology if I want one group to be able to see what another group is doing.
Exactly.
So I can improve what they can see with technology. And when I want to do that, that's when I'm going to adopt it. And when I can do that, I can't get them to write math easily so everybody can see it yet. But when that's available, I'll do that.
One at a chalkboard.
Yes, they do that.
Last time I looked, they could all look, unless they're blind, they could look at the chalkboard.
But, so I think that goes back to sort of the I want to do a sort of folding back into something we said before, and also then another kind of fly in the ointment. The one is going back to this original, you know, no matter what the question is, technology needs to be in the answer. And I think we need to question that assumption, because what you were just saying, Barbara, is, you know, sometimes technology wasn't in the answer. What Mike was saying, sometimes technology isn't in the answer. Mm-hmm. And we've got to be okay with that and be in the honest query for improving learning.
Right.
The second piece goes back to the instructional design. I just want to mention something that was kind of interesting that happened around the table discussion yesterday at one of the keynotes. We were talking about, well, what do you call instructional designers? And somebody said, well, why are we calling this instructional design? Instruction is such a loaded term in terms of that there's a knower who is instructing another. Why are we not calling it learning design? So I think that we struggle, and we've got a blended learning initiative on our campus, and it's so funny because we're realizing that our own language still is privileging. Well, we'll have the face-to-face class and then you'll work online, instead of why isn't the learning also online? Why isn't it really blended? And I think we need to question our own language, so that if we're saying that we really want to transform teaching and learning as we know it, but we're still referring to instruction or we're still referring to training or whatever, then we need to become more reflective, walk our talk a little bit more.
I think it's okay, though, that the word instruction has come to mean something other than the actual literal. It now means facilitate learning. I think it now is a word that has changed its meaning. I think that's all right. I'm not sure we have to change to the word learning, but
it seems to me, Mike, you were talking a few minutes ago about what was the term, active learning. Mm-hmm. It seems to me we're also in an era at the same running parallel to all these discussions of technology, that there's new discussions on techniques for students to learn better. Certainly weren't around when I was in college 30 years ago. It was stand up and lecture, take your notes, end of discussion. And things of like student-centric learning, active learning, which are techniques that are independent of technology. Technology could perhaps, in the right circumstances, facilitate some of those. So, you know, it's, I don't know what other folks' thoughts are on, it just seems to be an era of change. I keep going back to that change. It's just a lot going on in parallel with technology being one of many variables affecting the classroom.
I think we'll move on to one more question here.
We got all horse. That on one.
We beat that horse to death, didn't we?
So what do the students need to know? Countless articles and student surveys have underscored the need for information fluency training in our colleges, and there seems to be an agreement that training is necessary, but much debate on how to approach it. How do we teach students to find and critically evaluate information, and are there examples from your own campuses?
I'm not faculty, but I have an immediate reaction to that question, which is I get uncomfortable whenever there's a discussion about let's mandate and create a defined IT fluency or literacy or whatever you want it to be with rubrics and assessments and this and that. My institution has been down that path multiple times, and we've had multiple discussions about it, and we've had efforts to create a standardized literacy model, IT literacy. Well, by the time you get enough people organized to then define what in the world it is that we want to assess, and then to create a learning environment, some method of teaching folks that, it's been a year. And whatever you've gotten to at that point, you've already run way past it. So it's not that the conversation doesn't come up on our campus. Now it tends to be more around faculty. There's still this hand-wringing of, our faculty need to know more about this stuff. And my group, because of our job title, we're looked to try to do that. And I resist it, not because I don't think it's a good idea, but because I'm not sure how you get your hands around something like that.
You certainly can't make your goals in terms of any specific skills or any specific, you know, skills, especially because
those
are going to change. They're going to change so fast. Students can't take something in their
skills
first year that's going to be useful or relevant when they graduate. But if there might be ways to define your goals in a way that transcends the current state, that's independent of state.
I'm interested in ideas.
Like for example, I would say a goal would be that a student who graduates shouldn't be inhibited by a technological challenge. They should rise to a technological challenge and not be afraid by it. That would be a goal that's independent of where we currently stand.
I think it may be better served to look at information literacy rather than information technology literacy. Information literacy, I think, is an absolute essential thing that a student getting, you know, a degree needs to have. They need to have the ability to find information, manipulate that information, and disseminate that information. And the mechanisms that they'll go by to do any of those things are going to constantly be changing. They're also very variable, if that's the way to put that, per disciplines. My discipline is nursing. You know, finding information and manipulating information in my discipline is going to be totally different than finding information and manipulating it and disseminating it in mathematics or in computer science or something like that. So if we can define, first of all, that those are three major goals that we want to have as an end objective for a degree, then I think it's up to disciplines and departments and curriculum and so forth to decide, how do we evaluate, can a student find information? In my discipline, that might be being able to manipulate the medical databases in the library to find that kind of information. In somebody else's, it's something else. So I don't think that there can be a pat set of skills, a pat set of outcomes that will define and assess information technology literacy. But there may be some ways to at least narrow down if a student is able to say they are information literate.
I go back to, I see this Venn diagram, and one piece is information technology fluency. One is the information literacy, and another is this kind of media literacy piece. And they're all overlapping. And as we talk about how we are interdependent now to be able to do some of this stuff in the classroom, those literacies are interdependent. So, for example, you know, with nursing, you may have the how to look up whatever within some kind of database, but that might be being mediated through a PDA. And I could, you know, think any of a number of pieces, you know, like that. And so I think that when it comes down to one point, one domain, I worry that we're missing out on some of the interconnectedness. And that's some of what we've tried to do. I tend to agree with Sandy that it's a real challenge by the time you get an assessment together. It's obsolete. But one of the things that we've tried to do is get some of the larger pieces, some of the larger fluencies, and then online say, here are some of the resources that are out there that might help you meet some of those, and leave it up to the students with proper check-ins to say, okay, and we call it ICOMS. I agree again with Sandy that about some of the limitations and structures. One second piece too, we're talking about this as a training issue or a training need, and everything that we sort of know about learning so far is that things take on meaning and reality when they're embedded, when they're authentic. And so if we're trying to treat this as a parallel track or a co-curricular track, I think we're going to be in trouble. One example at our campus is we had Joe Lambert come in to do a week-long institute on digital storytelling. And this was for faculty and staff, faculty and library staff. One of the faculty members that took it, School of Management, Sylvia Maxfield, made a digital story. And in making the digital story, she saw implications for her classroom. So then she incorporated a parallel track so that she had the safety net in her corporate social responsibility. Students could either do a traditional written case or they could create a digital case. Students created the digital case. The digital cases worked really well. For example, one on the role of pesticides in the cut flower industry and how emerging countries were overusing those pesticides in order to compete in the global market. 2 to 3 minute video. From that, Sylvia and her students and I were asked to give a presentation at Harvard Business School's Brain Gain. From that, they were asked to write it up, and it became an exemplary practice on the Aspen Institute website. So that's some of the bang for the buck that you get when it's part of their learning. And they're saying, wow, you know, some of these media literacies that I'm learning are immediately relevant in my workplace, but they have substance. You know, they're grounded in the needs of the discipline. And I don't see a cheap way around that. Sylvia had space and time to make her own. So she's not asking students to do stuff she hasn't done yet. She had a lot of support from us.
Somebody yesterday said, make it an opportunity, not a requirement.
If you make them want the information and want to do things with it, they will naturally figure out how to do those things. But I do think we need to encourage them to create. The main lesson I get at ELI is the reminder that it's all about students creating content. And that won't happen naturally. That we have to make happen to get them wanting to create stuff. And then they will learn the technology to do it. I don't see the need to have the technological part be a separate thing at all. Like you say, it shouldn't be a separate parallel thing. They'll master the technology. They should have help available. There should be available workshops and even having a part of a class be a workshop and how do you get started on a tool. That's fine.
I had a hallway conversation with somebody yesterday going back to Barbara's point about digital literacy versus information literacy. And we came to this conclusion that maybe we are, you know, this question of digital versus information, that we should almost, I hate to say, scratch the digital literacy from it. But really the take-home message is really the information literacy. In this day and age, information, going back to our keynote this morning, obviously information is, access to information is cheap. It's essentially free. It's discerning what's relevant information, useful information, is the challenge. And as you said, Jerry, that finding a way to use a little camera or a device is not a particularly challenging issue these days. It's coming up with some way to make it useful as a learning exercise. So really, I think the real question that I should be collecting data on and asking people is information literacy or information fluency.
It even circles back to what Mike said back early in the beginning about getting content across. I mean, it's getting to the point nowadays, and it sort of brings in your comment about there is so much information now. We are getting to the point that maybe there is so much content out there that there's no way to cover it. So maybe we look at how do you help a student figure out what is the priority information? What information do you have to know, but what information can you go find that will supplement what you know? And in the long run, you end up still an educated person, but there wasn't as much emphasis on this is the set amount of content that I have to cover.
I want to go back to this idea of literacy, because with literacy, to be literate not only means in the traditional sense to be able to read critically, but it's also about being able to write. And I think that in the writing or in the making of, it changes our understanding. And by extension, the doing of. So, for example, we're playing this augmented or alternative reality game at the conference. How will people understand what that means in a different way because they have played it? Some of us have been involved in making it. How will our understanding of what an ARG is be different because we have made it? How will the understanding of the podcast be different because we've edited out the ums and ers and we know what can be deleted and how that can change the sense of content? While I agree that the tutorials are all around us, there's a gazillion great tutorials out there. But then there's the other question of what are we teaching? Are we teaching not only how to learn from this and gather information as appropriate, but how to make it in a way that is congruent with sort of the level of expectation that we have with higher education. And I think that students are coming into college, yes, they have Facebook accounts, yes, they have this, that, the other, but have they been using this to make that higher education level of meaning? And how would our courses need to be designed to be able to do that, to be literate in that sense of the term?
I have an immediate reaction that I've come to this conclusion. There's been discussions about, will the faculty member be relevant as we move in the future? As I listen to your comments, Gail, that I think the faculty member is more important than ever before to helping guide the student through that process of making sense out of all of this. That's where I've had a complete flip of that mindset, and obviously it's incumbent upon faculty, all of us, to recognize, perhaps, if that's true. You know, we could just turn students loose and say, well, there's this vast world of information, sally forth and become knowledgeable, right? Well, we all know, we laugh. Our immediate reaction to that is laugh. So it's not a shortage of information. The shortage is making sense out of that information that's meaningful at a level we consider, as you said, congruent with higher education. And, you know, I don't know, Mike, what are your thoughts on that as an instructor?
Well, one thing is contributing, for example, to a wiki is a good way for a student to learn skepticism about a source. Because they could look at that and say, you know, that could have been me, and I'm not that smart. So it kind of feeds itself. The producing can be a major lesson in the consuming, too. So, and the instructor is it's just essential that we help guide them
to
do the right things that will teach them those lessons.
I totally agree with that, but it also makes me think that faculty and those that are instructing have to change their mindset a little bit. And here, coming back to the fact that a lot of us may teach the way we were taught. So it's really going to be a challenge and a growing change for faculty to approach it the way that you're talking about. Again, rather than delivering a set amount of content, to being able to manipulate that content or manipulate the flow of moving toward that information. So it's going to require not only a little bit of change in terms of the student, but it's going to require some change in terms of the faculty approach as well.
I think it'll be an enormous challenge.
I go back to the editing a tape or editing a document, you wind up seeing what can be edited out. Contributing to a wiki, you wind up seeing how you could totally mess with information if you wanted to. And that is a lesson that can be learned, but by default, editing a tape doesn't teach you that. By default, contributing to a wiki doesn't teach you that. So I think if we don't intentionally build into the learning cycle some kind of metacognitive discourse,
reflection,
then that opportunity will be missed. And so then again, that goes back to time. I think we may need to be covering less to be able to create the time to have that last cycle or last leg of the learning that's then going to spring them on to the next adventure.
Adventure, I like that term.
So we'll end there and say that the main commodity we need is time.
Yes, that's
any technology, any technology we know that manufactures time?
Not yet.
Yeah,
we'll work on it.
Rare commodity.
Yes. Barbara, Sandy, Gail, Mike, thank you so much for your time and expertise. I very much appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.